As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. Matt Slater with us as usual. Ahead of the Champions League finals, both men's and women's, our guest today is Craig Thompson, who's worked on major global sports projects spanning 17 sports across 66 countries. He was one of the founders of the UEFA Champions League and served for 11 years as managing director for team marketing, the commercial agency for the competition. Just take us through, first of all, Craig, your career. Welcome to the pod.
Born in Los Angeles, migrated to Europe in 1986, joined ISL Marketing, which was a brilliant agency that had exclusive rights for World Cup, Olympic Games, European Championships. I was luckier than you can believe to get in there, learn the business. Our chairman died in 1989, Horst Dassler, the son of Adi Dassler of Adidas. We realized that the new chairman was not going to be the right guy to carry us forward. A group of us left, started team marketing in 1991. It was actually started. I joined in 1992. We did not have the Champions League when we started the team marketing. Got that in February of 92. Small group of us. Started building our team and our project around the Champions League. We launched the first matches in November. The rest of that is history. Went off to spend some time with my family in the south of France in 2003, which was very enjoyable, but got bored and started working again, started the Champions Hockey League, very similar to Champions League football for ice hockey in 2008, and then left back for America after 25 years. To San Francisco to run the America's Cup for Larry Ellison, the owner of Oracle. Since that time, have been doing a lot of commercial consulting and started a company called Mindspring Capital, which does early stage sport tech investment. We're a small venture capital company.
Wow. That's some association with some remarkable people. And of course, one of the main reasons for getting you on is to talk about the Champions League and to go back to that era when that was rebranded, revamped from the European Cup. Back then, moving from the European Cup to the Champions League, what was everybody looking for?
There was a general feeling among some of the clubs that the commercial rights in that they had in the Champions Club Cup were not being exploited efficiently. In other words, clubs always want more money and they'll do anything they can to get it. So some pressure was coming from a few clubs, but it's really, you know, the Champions League should never have happened. Sport is very traditional, is very resistant to change. In those days, we were very, very lucky that Lennart Johansson had become president of UEFA. He's a Swedish businessman, a very acute businessman, and he could see that these rights were not being efficiently exploited. So, you know, they actually did an experiment in the 91-92 season. They took the final eight teams from the Champions Club Cup and put them into two groups. Had them play off, and the winner of each group played for the final. They liked it. They said, okay, we're going to do it again in 92, 93, but this time we need to launch it as an official competition. We need a partner for that. And so they put it out to tender, and we got it. Then the majority of clubs said, no, we don't want it. The executive board of UEFA said, no, we don't want it. And the journalists around the world, after we launched it, said they didn't want it because how could you take the Champions Club Cup, which is based on home and away matches, which you win or you lose, you know, you live or die, and put it into a league? Is this some kind of American scam to bring to Europe? You know, if you lose a match, you're out. So it was very, very difficult at first. And then in our first season, we didn't have, you know, we had sold the TV rights individually, country by country. Germany, England, and Spain, three of the five major markets, didn't have a team that qualified in the competition. That almost put us under as well. So it was quite a difficult start in other ways than that as well. But that was what was going on.
Isn't it interesting that 30 years ago, a lot of the themes then still crop up in a lot of our discussions with sports and commercials and broadcasters, even now, which is the two things that strike me there is one, a resistance to change, and two, always a suspicion that a sport is trying to be Americanized. I mean, they're the two things that seem to crop up more than anything else, Craig, it feels like.
Well, unfortunately, football is trying to be Americanized. Now, it's not just the Americans. It's also the Gulf investors. It's some Russians. The Super League, you know, was so ill-conceived and ill-prepared. One of the happy days in my life was when the Manchester United supporters, you know, went to the stadium to protest about this. Go fans, you know. At the end of the day, that's what this game's all about, isn't it? It's about the fans. And, you know, we have this beautiful system in Europe. I'm living in America, I guess I should say you have this beautiful system in Europe where, you know, the club system is open, you know, promotion and relegation. The smallest club can get to the top. Everybody's got a chance. It's all about, you know, every fan for their club has hope, you know, for the future. And, you know, you take that away when you start taking the top teams out of that system, putting them in a league by themselves and destroying really the beauty of European sports.
Did it take you back at all, the reaction to the European Super League, to the reaction in the early 90s to the Champions League?
Yes, yes. Because in those days, you know, the clubs, well, all the time, the clubs are super conscious about their revenue opportunities and their rights. We had to collectivize those rights into a central marketing pool in order to start the Champions League. I mean, we knew that those rights sold, collectively were much worth a lot more than what the clubs were getting for them individually. We knew that. But the clubs certainly didn't. And they were very, very skeptical that we could, you know, in fact, sell their rights for more than they could. We sold them for 100 times more than they could, you know, in the long run. But there was no knowledge of that among those clubs. And they were, I'll never forget the negotiation with Bernard Tapie, who was the owner of Olympique Marseille, who was a very astute businessman, the mayor of Marseille, protecting his club, you know, with his last ounce of energy. 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, we finished our negotiations with him because he just couldn't let go until he knew that his club was going to come out okay financially. And we had to change the rules for all the clubs because of that argument of his, which was to our detriment, but it's okay. It all worked out. But these same forces, the clubs always want more money. The clubs, unfortunately, don't care very much about the competition system that they're in. That for them is secondary. What they want is to play at the highest levels and to make the most money.
Craig, I was wondering if we could just take you back to 91, 92.
I hear all these clubs listening to me.
Yeah, sure. They listen. Don't you worry. They listen to us. If I could just take you back to 92, because I think you very modestly glossed over what is probably the greatest rebranding, relaunch in sports marketing history. You know, your first answer, it was, we started a company, we made a pitch, and then we relaunched this company, this club, this amazing competition. Take me back to February 92.
Okay. Leonard Johansson was smart enough to say, you guys, you're commercial experts, you have experience with football, other than me, you have experience with football, let's do this thing. And you lead that side. So Klaus and Jürgen, who came from Adidas as right-hand men of Horst Dassler, they were brand guys. I mean, both of them, they were big brand guys. And they, you know, from the very beginning, they say, aha, finally, we have an opportunity to brand a competition the way it should be branded. Let's grab this bull by the horns and make sure we do it. So behind that was their very perceptive thinking that football was in a sort of a crisis period at the time. There was, you know, England was even banned from international competitions. We wanted the Champions League to stand for the best of football. We called it the higher image of football. And that meant, you know, a lot of things. It meant getting rid of these standing areas in the stadiums, because that's where a lot of the violence took place. So cleaning up the stadiums, adding female, you know, restrooms and, you know, better concession services and better parking. All of this was, you know, and we had that in the regulations, you know, with UEFA, that to participate in the Champions League, you had to do that. But this higher image of football really meant the best clubs in Europe, which are probably the best clubs in the world, are now playing against each other on a regular basis. Therefore, the best players in the world are participating. And how can we position this from a brand perspective that captures that what we want to communicate? And so in those days, everybody would have used rock music. Everyone. We went classical. I got the brief from Klaus and Jürgen. We want classical music. Go find it. That was my brief. I found Tony Britton through a music agency in London, which it's all of this is timing and luck. And, you know, Tony was a really good composer, took a work by Haydn and repurposed it quite a bit for the Champions League. We added lyrics, French, English, and German at the first playing of the Champions League music in the rehearsal hall at the London Symphony Orchestra. And, you know, I mean, I've got goosebumps to this day from hearing that the first time. And it's just, you know, it's remarkable what he did. It's not changed ever since. And it's probably the most famous anthem of music in the world today, I would say.
Why did they want classical?
Because classical was how to position this in a higher level, you know, as more sophisticated, as more, you know, what are the right adjectives? Classical music is a whole different mood, isn't it? I mean, people get married today to the classical music of Champions League. I mean, I can't believe it, but it's true. So, and it was stunning. You know, no one had ever heard classical music played at a football match before. I mean, not to my knowledge. So it was something we always wanted to be innovative and different. And then there was a star ball, okay, which I also had to find the design agency to do the star ball. I got the brief, the higher image of football, the stars of the game. And that was really the brief. You know, we have the star clubs and we have the star players. Create a logo to represent that. This agency called Design Bridge, led by Rod Petrie, who's still a very good friend who lives in Surrey or someplace like that, came up. They got their designers together and somebody came up. They started sketching around a star. And then one guy got the idea, we can make a star pattern into the shape of a ball. And is that perfect or what? I mean, the stars representing the best players, the best teams, and the ball representing the sport. I mean, it was a stroke of genius. And again, the first time everyone saw it, they just went, that's it. Yeah, I've been in branding all my life. I've never seen anyone agree to a brand on the first time. And that was, you know, just universal acceptance. So we were really lucky to work with brilliant people in the music and design worlds that were able to do that for us. And then we took that and we executed it. Okay. And, you know, we created the Champions League experience. And to this day, I'm kind of shocked how easy it was to do. But it was because of this powerful thinking that had been done with the music and the brand. We had to make a very big decision at the start of the Champions League. In those days, if Manchester was hosting Juventus in the Champions Club Cup, they would organize the game like they organize every game at Manchester. And we said, wait a second, this is the Champions League. This is not every game at Manchester. This has got to be something special. How are we going to do that? And we said, well, we're going to have to get UEFA to write in the regulations that team and UEFA are going to come in and have the organizational responsibility for the pitch, for the design of the stadium, for the parking, for the hospitality areas, for the TV camera positions. That was a landmark decision. I still can't believe to this day that UEFA decided to do it, because the clubs hated it. They absolutely hated it. They were against us the minute we got to the club. I went to Man United for the first time when they got qualified. I wasn't in the first year. And I was telling them of all the conditions for being in the Champions League. I came to the hospitality room and described a room for 300 people with, you know, access to the VIP seats and good access from the parking. And they said, well, we only have one room, and that's our room, Craig, and you won't be having that. And I said, well, we have a problem, because we have sponsor contracts in place that give them the right to bring guests to that room. Of course, we'll have some of your top people from the club, but there's broadcaster guests, there's sponsor guests, there's UEFA guests, and that room will be filled with those guests, 300 people. And so, you know, this is part of the regulations, and I'm sorry, but we're going to have to ask for that room. And he said, excuse me, this is a room of 20 people sitting around a table. Excuse me, Craig, where are you from? He knew where I was from, my accent. I said, American. He goes, I thought so. And you bloody well know nothing about football.
He wouldn't get away with that now. But Craig, I mean, so much has changed. Mm. I mean, we could sort of go through the list, but UEFA, what was UEFA like back then? Because they gave you space. They let you do it. And I wonder if it's because they were very small themselves.
You know, in those days, you know, today when you go to UEFA, see this big monstrosity on the Lake of Lausanne and the Lake of Geneva, and unbelievably beautiful buildings. And, you know, I don't know how many people they have now, but in those days, UEFA was in two floors of a high-rise building in Bern, Switzerland. You know, I don't know how many people they have, but it couldn't have been more than 50. Now they have hundreds. That was, again, part of this, you know, this miracle that the Champions League became possible, because they realized, Lennart Johansson realized, that their marketing director, who was a very good guy, but he didn't have the range of experience that we brought from World Cup and from Olympic Games. And so we worked together with him, but we took the lead, and they didn't have media people, because in those days, all the rights were centralized with EBU, you know, so they had that one discussion, but we had people that were, you know, media rights specialists. And so he could see the writing on the wall, and he very rightfully said, you know, over to you guys, keep us informed. We've got the sport, you know, we've got the referees, we've got the relations with the clubs, you know, but you guys bring us the commercial program.
Were you and UEFA and the Champions League, were you the first to do that homogenous look at every stadium? I mean, yeah, sometimes I struggle to remember last week, let alone, you know, the 1984 Olympics, for example, but you know, were the Olympics at the time, did they always have a different look depending on where the country was? Because now, if you think about it, Craig, every single big sporting event from the Euros to a World Cup to the ICC Women's T20 to Olympics, every venue used for those tournaments all look the same. And that tournament, whatever that tournament may be, looks the same virtually every 4 years, wherever it's being held.
I can't answer the question who else was doing it, but I know that it wasn't many people. It wasn't many events. And again, Klaus and Jürgen, from this brand background that they had, you know, it was, you know, how are we going to make the champ? You know, when we looked at it from this perspective, people are flipping through the channels looking for football, and we want them to see that star ball. And when they see it, they're going to stop, because it's Champions League, it's the best. And that was the kind of thinking that we were doing. And so how do you get them to stop? So, you know, you have the lineup, you've got a big center circle behind the players. You've got the ball boys with star ball pullovers. You've got all the boards always in the same configuration with the UEFA Champions board in the middle. Drove the sponsors absolutely crazy. They said, that's our space, you cannot take that. We said, no, that's Champions League space. We're very sorry. And the Champions League is what's going to lift, you know, carry all the boats in this parade. So we insisted on that. But then in those days, if you remember, there was not just one tier of advertising. There was two or three. In Italy, there might have been five. Then at the first tier, there was a whole nother set of advertising. In the second tier, and a whole nother set. We couldn't have those competing brands. So what did we do? We designed this star ball material, and we hung it up around the stadium first tier, second tier scoreboards. It wasn't that it wasn't that much of a work, right, to do those things. You played the music at the lineup. I couldn't believe the sense of occasion that this created for the fans, and how, you know, it was, this was something special, and it was, but I was amazed how easily we could do it. It worked.
The decision back then not to have a title sponsor, was that again to elevate it as this special competition, or was that a financial decision that actually brand partners, if there's a group of them, might bring in more than a title sponsor? Because late 80s, early 90s was when title sponsors really started, certainly in European competitions, you know, the Canon First Division, I think it was, the Heineken Cup, whereas actually more and more, the Premier League decided to ditch their title sponsor, didn't they, maybe a decade ago, something like that, I think, and have brand partners. So what was the thinking behind that?
So as I mentioned, we came from ISL Marketing. And at ISL Marketing, for the Olympic Games, there were no sponsors visible. But anyway, every competition that we had, except for one, every single competition had a sponsor family of official sponsors. So this was started by Horst Dossler when he created ISL in the first place back in the 80s. And that was the way we did things. The exception was the Toyota Cup in Japan that was sponsored, you know, by Toyota. But other than that, everything was a family of sponsors. That was part of it. The other part of it was that, you know, in the creation of this commercial program, which was really revolutionary in the time, you know, centralizing the rights. But then what do you do with those rights? The biggest thing we did was, because of the fact that broadcasters at that time had to have, this was must have content, right? It was not a like to have, this was a must have. So we were in the driver's seat, even though it was a new competition that had never been done before. So there was uncertainty there, but the promise of having Juventus and Bayern Munich and Real Madrid playing every week was enough that we were able to leverage that strength and tell them that the rights payment was one thing, but on top of that, they had to give us broadcast sponsorship. This was it was not being done in Europe ever at that time. It was being done in Japan and in America, in fairness, but it wasn't being done in Europe. They fought like hell. I mean, they didn't want to give us that in the worst way. And we said, well, we're going to go to your competitor because they will give it to us. And I'm not sure if they would have given it to us or not, but but we got it. And that was the first time that sponsorship had actually been, you know, really integrated into the television program. We had it, you know, that this program is brought to you by, we did the opening sequence, yep. We embedded the brands, and then we said this program is brought to you by Ford and MasterCard. Then they got it immediately after the first half. Then they got it immediately before the second half. Then they got it immediately after the, so we had to have the running order from every broadcaster, second by second, what they were doing from on camera to the end of the program, so that we could make sure that all this commercial content was going to be, you know, placed properly. I mean, we got into the broadcasters' beds with them in a way that they did not like. Yeah. They wouldn't use our graphics. So, you know, we had, you know, the Champions Star Ball, we that had to be in the graphics. We had our opening sequence, what they would use. But then when there was a substitution or a red card or a penalty kick, they wouldn't have, you know, these things coming up with the Star Ball. We had to have Delta Tray, which is now a $1 billion company, they had these little Italian vans. They had to drive all over Europe to every match because the broadcaster said, if you bring the graphics to us, we'll do it, but we're not going to use your graphics otherwise. We have our own graphic. So we had to bring these little vans. These Italian guys were fantastic. And they're some of my good friends to this day. But so they had all the technical equipment. They plug it into the vans, and they had to be right next to the big Obi van. And then those guys would have all their food and their sleepy stuff, and they would sleep in the vans for like 3 or 4 days.
Wow!
To produce these matches, unbelievable.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Craig, going back to those conversations with clubs, and you're right, they always want more. But 91-92, it's a really interesting time because conversations have been had through the 80s, often led by guys like Silvio Berlusconi, around this idea there was too much jeopardy in the European Cup. And there are a couple of key occasions where 1987 is the most famous one, where the champions of Spain played the champions of Italy in the first round. I think it was Real Madrid versus Napoli.
Yeah,
Diego Maradona's Napoli. And Berlusconi, who was, of course, trying to put together a huge pay TV empire and was, you know, thinking that AC Milan were going to be that club the following year, and they were, they said, this is an economic nonsense. You cannot have one of the big giants going out in the first round. And of course, there was another example a few years before where Liverpool played Nottingham Forest, and you know, we knocked out Liverpool, the English champions. So it had happened. Now, did you ever sort of sense from those conversations around creating a group stage and giving the giants guaranteed games that you would get, or we would get, to where we are now?
All the credit for that goes to UEFA. We had nothing to do with it. We weren't even involved. They had decided, from these kind of pressures that you're talking about, they had decided to do a test, you know, and this was because of Lennart Johansson, Gerd Eigner. They were willing to think a little bit outside the box of the traditional, you know, UEFA president and take this chance. And it was very risky for UEFA to do this. That came from them. We have to be thankful for that wisdom of those guys.
And then, of course, the tournament grew during the 90s. And was it every other year it was tweaked, you know, whatever it was, you know, 3 points for a win or going them to a semi-final, or then it really went big. I think it was about 98, 99, was it, where we got the four teams from the big four markets. I mean, what was it like just being at that time where your baby, if you like, was growing?
Honestly, I don't think we ever talked. I don't remember ever talking from the earliest days at team with my colleagues. I don't ever remember talking about the Champions League becoming 16 teams someday or 32 teams. I don't think we were thinking about that. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not aware of it. Success breeds success, right? And you know, with what we were doing in those first few years, I mean, it wasn't that long until it took us to get to 16 teams. It was more maybe 96, I would say, or maybe, you know, it was obvious that, and part of this is UEFA. Lennart Johansson and Gerd Eigner were thinking about, part of their reason for wanting to do the Champions League was to make sure that the money from football went back into football. Okay. And they were, you know, they were very, very religious about that, because that's how you grow the game. And that's how you get reelected president also. but they really put their money where their mouth was. I mean, they funded not only the teams that were in the Champions League, but they funded teams that couldn't have qualified. They funded, you know, national associations, referees training, and lots of things were that money was used for. Everyone got happy, you know, with this. And but the happiest people were the clubs that were in it, right? And so that created a jealousy. Yeah. And everyone could see that those clubs that were in it, all of a sudden, they had a budget plus, right? They had the same old budget plus Champions League. Now, you know, what does that do to the competitive balance in a league? Yeah, when you have all that extra money to buy players with. So that created a lot of pressure. And this is the same problem today that we have. Those clubs that are in the Champions League, what happens when they go out? The next year, they've got a way big budget that was inflated by the Champions League. They've got all those costs and they got to start cutting things. And it kills them. And this is one of the big reasons why all these clubs are pushing today, every day, they're pushing to be able to stay in the Champions League no matter how they perform. That's wrong. I'm sorry. That's wrong. If you don't perform, you don't belong. This is not a free ride, this world. You know, you're the greatest club that ever lived, but you might be crap tomorrow. If you are, we don't want you. Sorry. That's what competition is all about. I mean, what's the matter with these guys?
If you were to launch a Champions League now, what would be the biggest challenges, or what would you be searching for to guarantee success? Because we live in arguably we live in a much more global society, don't we, Craig, than we did 30 years ago. So if you were to launch an elite European competition now, what would you be looking for to ensure success?
This might be a strange answer for you, but what I would look for is controlling access to the fan data. In 1992, there was no such thing as fan data. Well, maybe some ticketing companies had something, but today fan data runs the world. And it's starting to run the world. We estimate that maybe 10% of all sports fans in the world are actually in the database of their rights holder, of their club or their league or their federation, maybe 10%. Go to any other industry, commercial industry, and they know who their consumers are. We don't know. And it's sports is unfortunately always behind. I don't know why. Probably because of a bunch of old athletes like me that are running it. It's fan data. Fan data, all the money from sports comes from the fans. And, you know, if you're paying sponsor money, well, the sponsors are paying because the fans are buying their products. You know, all the money comes from the fans. And so, you know, and that's got to be respected. You can't take the fan to the point where they can't afford it anymore. That's a huge problem in football.
That subject is really interesting because you know, as you talk about different commercial organizations having their customer data, if I buy a vacuum cleaner, I bought a vacuum cleaner and I suppose it's very easy to collect my data from the store that I bought it for or online or whatever. But fan data is going to have so many different layers, Craig, isn't it? Because match-going fans are going to provide you with different data to American fans watching the Champions League to Australian fans watching the Champions League. And it's how you prioritize, I suppose, those different layers of data that you get.
Well, you want all of it. I mean, you take a product, Real Madrid or Champions League or, you know, a Rugby World Cup, you take a product, a sporting product, and then you access the data points, the fans, the participants and the fans from all over the world. And now, as you just said, we're living in a very global environment. And you get all of those interested people, whether it's buying a ticket to the game, which is, of course, the minority of people, the people that are watching on television, subscribing to an OTT, buying a piece of fan merchandise, looking on a website, looking on a piece of content, all of those looks or purchases are traceable, okay, through yeah. modern technology. And yes, we have to get the permission of the fans to use their data and so on. And then you index that database so that you have various types of fans, age, demographics, economics, social, you know, you can get fans' likes and dislikes off of Facebook and things like that. So this is getting very sophisticated. And the sponsors, of course, they're using this for their own, with their own consumers. They want it for the sports world so they can then, you know, activate their products and campaigns, you know, with those sports fans. This is really kind of one of the big movements in sports today, is accessing and then using this fan data. Everyone talks about this in terms of fan monetization, and that's wrong. Fan monetization is a part of it. But if we forget that the fan is the source of all we're doing, and we drive them out of it because we overcharge them and try to exploit them to such a degree. Fan engagement is what this is all about, in my opinion. If a fan is engaged, he might want to spend more money, but that's up to him. And we want to bring them closer to the sport. And that's what they want. They want better access. They want to be in the locker room to hear what the you know, the manager is saying to the players. And we're getting there. I mean, you know, Thomas Kurt, UEFA, was always so afraid of me because I came from America. And, you know, he said, Craig, stay away from the dressing room. Stay away. I know why you're here. I know why you're here. Try to get that camera in there, aren't you? You're here again, Craig. This is not possible. We're not going to have any cameras in our dressing room.
You're in London, I think. Whilst you're here, the band gets back together, doesn't it? And I think that sort of ties everything together really nicely. You are, I think, having a meal, or you're going to meet some people from 92, from the people that the class of 92.
Yeah,
the original class, the other class of 92, the guys that this product that we'll all be watching next week. And the anthem hasn't changed. The logo hasn't changed. You haven't changed. And you're all still friends. I think that's wonderful.
One of the geniuses of Team, and I think other companies are doing it now, but, you know, in those days you had your commercial people, you had your television people, you had your event people. They were all in different camps, okay? They all worked in silos. And the genius of Klaus and Jürgen was to say, you guys, we need you to work together. And so everyone that's in those commercial departments is also going to be helping us run the events. And in those days, when I first started, I was the operations guy. I was the one that ran the matches and figured out all that stuff. And so Klaus and Jürgen said to our two other commercial guys, Bernard DeRose and Tom Liston, you guys, by the way, are reporting to Craig when it comes to event management. And they were not happy at all, okay? Because they were commercial guys. They work on, you know, they're on top of the world. They're bringing all the revenue. You know, everyone forgets, you know, you can't have the revenue if you don't have good events and you don't have good. But anyway, what they do is, of course, extremely valuable. Everyone in the company had to work together, you know, to deliver these matches. We had a venue manager and a venue coordinator. The venue coordinators were generally our Swiss employees that were coordinators, managers that would go out and support a venue manager. And eventually, as time went by, it became venue managers as well. They were the backbone of the Champions League because they are organized, they are professional, they're on time, they are charming, and they were the ones that made those matches happen. You know, I created a set of checklists to run the matches with, which everyone hated, but I just couldn't stand the chaos of organizing a match without a system. So we did that. It worked eventually very well. It was going out to those matches together, and, you know, we left on a Sunday night. Okay, the match is on Wednesday. We had to be on a plane Sunday night. So you're leaving your family. You're setting up the club on Monday, Tuesday. You have the match on Wednesday. Thursday morning, we had the debrief, which was, you know, how we built the Champions League, really, was because we discussed everything that went wrong and got it right for the next match. And then we got home on Thursday afternoon, and we let everybody off on Friday afternoon to take a little break. But those venues, I mean, you know, the pressure's there. The clubs hated us in the first couple of years. Everything we did was, oh God, this fucking team again. You know, we were almost thrown out. I mean, UEFA had to save us many times. But we tried to be as diplomatic as we could. But anyway, the pressures were enormous. And that brought us together. We bonded. I mean, we are so close. We had a party last Saturday night in Lucerne, Switzerland, the base of Team Marketing. We invited all the people from the first 10 years, 85 people came from all over the world. We started at 5 in the afternoon. We had to kick people out at 2 in the morning. We had a dinner. It was the only time anyone sat down. It was like a beehive of, you know, everyone wanted to talk to everyone, and you couldn't have all those conversations at once. The energy level was as high as I've ever seen it in any gathering in my life. It was a totally enjoyable evening, and now everyone wants to keep doing it. So we're going to have another one in 5 years.
Just one to finish with on the future of the Champions League, and obviously it will be revamped again and a slightly different format brought in. And I know UEFA have, for the time being, have sort of I think they have, haven't they, Matt? Have they not sort of played down this one-off semi-finals and quarter-finals at the moment? Have they?
Oh, yeah, they've played that down.
They've played that down. Yeah. But we had a podcast, Craig, maybe a month ago, talking about the Paris Saint-Germain owner and him wanting the Champions League to be more like the Super Bowl. And we discussed whether a week of men's and women's semi-finals, women's final, under-23s final, and a men's final alongside concerts and so on and so forth would be a format that could work on all sorts of different levels in one host city. Could it, in your opinion?
I always wanted a Final Four. I'm American. Yep. We're big on Final Fours. But, you know, then you create a multiple day event. You create a festival atmosphere that is second to none. And you can do so much with that. What we do, what I do in my life, what I think I do, is try to make fans happy. Okay. That's what I see as my job. Sponsor money, broadcaster money. The event is where you make fans, and then the television is where you make them happy when they're at home. Final Four, in my opinion, makes the fans happier because they have a richer, more fulfilling experience over multiple days. There's just a lot more going on. I don't know about adding other sports to it. I personally would not be for that because I think the Champions League, you know, what's going to add value to the Champions League? I'm sorry. I don't want to be too bullish about that. But, you know, the Champions League doesn't need anything else. And I think it would just be a distraction. So, you know, but having a Final Four, I think makes a lot of sense.
Would they ever take it out of Europe?
That's a big, big question. And, you know, there's been people trying. Okay. I mean, you know, you've seen the Clásico mm-hmm. played in Miami. In my opinion, the answer is an undeniable, you know, is there other life in the universe? You know, it's an undeniable yes. We haven't seen it yet, but we know it's there, don't we? So it's just one of those things. It's inevitable. It's going to happen because the world demands it. You can't keep the Champions League just in Europe. It's too big a product now. It's got to go elsewhere. And they'll have to sort it out. Yes, it's inconvenient for the players to be on a jet for 10 hours. Okay. But, you know, come on, in today's world, and we've got faster jets coming in a few years, we've got to figure it out. You know, this is a global property. It's got to be global. So my message to UEFA is it's a matter of time, guys.
Absolutely fascinating to talk to you. I've loved it, Craig. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for the good questions, guys.
Right, that's it. Don't forget that right now you can subscribe for just £1 a month. Head to theathletic.com/footballpod. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.